107.5 FM, W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Tropical Storm Debbie leaves more than 100,000 power outages and flooding in Florida. It also leaves at least four deaths, including children. The storm center is over Georgia, moving very slowly, expecting to drop up to 30 inches of rain between now and Thursday in some areas of Georgia, and they're making preps in Raleigh, North Carolina.
We got all candles and batteries and flashlights and I had all that stuff ready.
There are several injuries after two rockets hit the U.S. and coalition air base in western Iraq, Al-Assad, says the Defense Department. A day after record losses for Japan's Nikkei stock index... This is the exchange opening Tuesday and rebounding to erase most of yesterday's losses. This after a big sell-off on Wall Street, the Dow losing more than 1,000 points. VP Kamala Harris expected to name her running mate choice tomorrow, after which both will travel to a rally in Philadelphia. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The first cases of West Nile virus infections in Wisconsin this year have turned up in a would-be blood donor in Washington County and a dead bird in Chippewa County. It means infected mosquitoes are transmitting the virus to people and animals. 150 people at three wood product factories are out of a job, Lisa Hale reports.
Wisconsin Veneer and Plywood of Mattoon and Goodman Veneer and Lumber Company informed the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development that they would close the facilities and terminate all employees Friday, August 2nd. Birchwood Manufacturing and Rice Lake also closed. The companies are all owned by Bessie Forest Products Group. They said unprecedented industry downturn forced the closures. I'm Lisa Hale.
And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
The Todd Alba Show.
Trigvi Olson, Senior Advisor with the Lincoln Project.
You know, one of the things I think that you've done with this show, and I'm proud to be a part of it, is we've really tried to get out and listen to people.
And that's why I'm so thankful to work for a company like Civic Media that allows us to do that. Because the more we get out and listen to our friends and neighbors, we discover they're not our enemy. We're all Americans, and yeah. It really is a melting pot.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about today. 43 years ago on this very day, the sainted Ronald Reagan fired the Patco workers in what I call the shot heard cross the boardroom where, hey, corporate America, it's time to go after those workers. Open season on unionized workers. And understand, when I started working, you know, union density in this country was around 30%, 25% in the private sector. That was 1985. 1979, there were around 21 million unionized workers in this country. Now you're around 14 million. Understand, from 1979 to now, our population has exploded. And, well, the unions have not. And the reason, again, comes back to this day in 1981, when Reagan fired the Patco workers. Not only fired them, but banned them from federal employment ever, ever, ever again. Now you fast forward all these years, and right now we're sitting at about 10% union density, as opposed to the 25% when I entered the workforce. 6% in the private sector, about 33% in the public sector. Which is why, again, you have the Republicans who are hell-bent on going after government unions. Because that's where the power is. That's where the density is. And understand, you know, during Reagan's tenure, they, outside of the firing of the Patco workers, there was mass opposition to unions. They supported the no rights at work agenda. They refused to raise the minimum wage. They went after collective bargaining rights. They went after union rights. They did everything they could do to hold down, to hamper workers' ability to organize, especially as their high dollar policy was shipping millions of jobs out of this country. So as we were deindustrializing the country, we were not allowing new industries to unionize. And again, you wonder why our standard of living has been falling from that period to now. Here's a huge part of it. And Reagan, you know, during his term, appointed horrible people to the Department of Labor, horrible people to the National Labor Relations Board. These were anti-union people in charge of organizations that are supposed to help workers, supposed to encourage collective bargaining. Understand what our law says and what it means. The government is supposed to encourage collective bargaining. The idea is that you solve problems locally. The employer and the employees, they come together and they bargain collectively. Maybe you've heard this. It's called collective bargaining. And they solve problems locally. You don't need big overarching government to tell you what to do, but encourage people to come together and talk. Reagan was the guy who really put his boot on the neck of working people. And, you know, you think about all of the massive tax breaks that he gave to the very wealthy in corporate America. You think about all of the things that they did to shift the balance of power. The pendulum of power swung to the wealthy and to corporations in enormous ways as we were deregulating, as we weren't raising the bottom up. In fact, we demonized the poor. If you remember, the welfare queen, she was driving around in a Cadillac, drinking Dom, eating steak every day on your dime. And everyone knows who the welfare queen was supposed to be. Looks a lot like the woman who's running for president, if you listen to them. And understand, this narrative that they paint, this image that they paint, it's powerful. It's divisive. And it's been used masterfully to destroy what was once the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. Reaganomics did that. Neoliberalism did that. This push towards sending all of our jobs overseas and saying, you can just get an education. You can do something else. You can do something in the service sector. You can wash my dog or wash my windows. And those good high-paying union jobs, those are gone, never to come back. And Reagan was one of those guys who, at every front, did what he could do to hold down. Now, again, remember, it was the time. You know, when I started working, Ohio was about 30% union density in the private sector. Pennsylvania, where I now live, was about 33%. Union density. Now you're talking somewhere in the for the private sector. In a state like Pennsylvania, to be under 14% is enormous. And the idea was, well, to create a desperation class of workers. And they've done that masterfully. And now fast forward here to Project 2025, where they're telling us they want to finish the job. They want to pick up the mantle that Reagan started today, 43 years ago, and they want to finish it off. We're going to let the free market, the invisible hand, decide. And how's that invisible hand been working out? I know it's been giving me the invisible finger, because I go back to this era. When I started working in 1985, the first union job I got had considerably more disposable income. And if you use that little Bureau of Labor Statistics thing, that little widget they got for the inflation calculator, was making a lot more. So the question is where did that wealth go? Where did the wealth that my wages used to help me create, where did that go? Well, we know where it went. It went to the very wealthy, to Elon Musk, to Bezos, to people who aren't paying taxes. And we are now living the Reagan dream. Rich people walk away from, shirk their responsibility, and poor people are, well, desperate enough to take crummy jobs. at crummy wages. And it all started really heavy with the firing of 11,000 air traffic controllers. And why were they fired? Because they had the audacity to say they wanted to be paid a reasonable wage, and they wanted to get rid of the antiquated equipment that was stressing them out to the point of exhaustion. Something we never talk about. Oh, and by the way, Reagan had said he supported all of that stuff while he was running for office. While he was campaign Reagan, he was on their side as President Reagan jabbed him in the back. Oh, and one last thing. All those people who lost their jobs and had to collect unemployment, because of Reagan, they began taxing unemployment for the very first time. It's one of those little niceties that Reagan stuck in there for you. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Sarah Burris after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got an email from Robert in New Mexico asking if I knew about Trump's Secretary of Retribution and asked if I was on the targeted list of 350 people who Trump wants to arrest. And I don't know. Honestly, I kind of would be proud to be on the list. 350 is a big number, but not really big enough when you're looking at the number of people who Trump, I'm sure, has an axe to grind with. But, well, I guess we may find out. But to have a Secretary of Retribution, really? Why not? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day and all the fun and entertainment going on this political season, our good friend Sarah Burris, reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. So any chance of finding out who these 350 people are?
God, I wish, right? I'm pretty sure that it's most elected Democrats and then probably some of the media people that... The thing about Trump, though, is like he has a love-hate relationship with the media, right? So it's like he hates all of these people, you know, like Nicole Wallace and Jake
Maggie
Tapper
Haberman.
And those folks. Right, right. But then he also desperately needs them. So, I always am nervous that, you know, that I am on the list, not simply because I'm a big deal, but because I'm accessible. Like, I'm just up the road. It would be really easy to just snatch me because, you know, I'm like a mile and a half away. So that always makes me really nervous. And my mother tells me things like, why don't you come home before, you know, inauguration instead?
No, as I've said, like, look, I'm not afraid of heights. I prefer not to be up high. And I don't bounce as well as I used to. So if you hear me falling out of a fifth floor window, it was not voluntary.
Yeah. Definitely. Thank God I don't live on the fifth floor.
So there you go. But is it surprising that this conversation would come up, that there would be? Because, look, he said that he wants retribution. He wants payback. He wants all this stuff. So would it be surprising if we had a czar of retribution?
I wouldn't be surprised at all. I think what would end up happening is that immediately there would be a congressional investigation or a Senate investigation into that department. And I think, you know, I would it be under the Department of Justice? Like, would it be for the FBI? Or I just don't know how necessarily it would function. And how I think the second you end up in court with these people, there's no real way to fight something like that from the Trump perspective. Like, there is no law that gives him that ability unless he passes an executive order, at which point then it, you know,
he's got immunity.
Yeah. I mean, but I think in terms of just the actual functioning of the government and whether the government can do something like that, I think it ends up, you know, being shut down by a federal judge, going to the Supreme Court. And then you have a question of, you know, does the Supreme Court love Donald Trump enough to essentially eliminate the First Amendment? And I mean, I'm sure there are probably a couple of judges who'd be fine with it.
And that is the weird place that we find ourselves, isn't it? Also, I'm sure you saw over the weekend the clip of Donald Trump saying that how smart Vladimir Putin was, and how Putin made a great deal. And you know, my mind goes to this place. Every time he says something like this, I'm a little bit surprised that, you know, someone would vote for someone who says those things. But then again, I kind of shake myself and go, no, we're in weird MAGA world.
We are in weird MAGA world. I mean, look at J.D. Vance. Like, that guy has the worst approval rating of any vice presidential nominee running mate in something like 44 years, is what I heard on NPR. 44 years. That's older than me. So, you know, that's, I mean, we're talking about, that includes Dan Quayle, dude. I mean, that's pretty bad, right? When you're worse than Dan Quayle, something ain't right.
So something's not right. And look, he's an unlikable guy because, you know, he's got really bizarre ideas, and it's this kind of draconian, you know, we're going to make the 1950s great again with a huge authoritarian bend.
That's exactly it. And it's not, there's no real other way to say it than weird, right? It's not normal. It's like, there is this obsession that people like J.D. Vance has with every minute detail in a woman's life, right? Like, from her cycle, from her pregnancy, from the number of cats that she has. I mean, are we going to start regulating cats now? Like,
we should. We should. I'm not a cat person. I could get on board with that.
Oh, man. Come on. You know, I'm pro animal across the board.
I'm pro animal, just not cats. You know, you can have them. I don't want a cat, although I've got one. But here's the thing, and you bring up the fact that, you know, this weird frame has been around for a while. I mean, look, you know, you could go back and look at January 6th, a lot of weird going on there. You could go back and look at the Tea Party. You go back and look at, you know, all of these movements of the extreme right. Weird comes to mind an awful lot. And, you know, finally now we're just kind of picking up that word. I thought bizarre, bat blank crazy. I thought a lot of those things in the past, but weird seems to have stuck.
Yeah, it's been so interesting. But I think one of the articles that I wrote this week has been a clinical psychologist who talked about the benefits of that word, the specificity it has, and the fact that it basically just shuts down the argument. That just saying something, you know, it's not like saying, oh, I disagree with you, or the facts say something else. If you just go, well, that's weird, and walk off, then that just kind of shuts everything down.
Yeah, but I always thought crazy would do that, but these people didn't mind crazy. Weird seems to bother them.
Which is super interesting, I think.
Which is weird.
Right? I think crazy maybe was, I don't know, maybe normies didn't like that word as much, but I think everybody seems to agree that this is not normal.
Right.
And I feel like the whole first term of Donald Trump, we talked about, you know, don't get used to this. Don't get accustomed to this being the new normal. It should not be normal. Right. These things are not normal, and don't accept it as normal. So I think calling it weird is really, it's just the new way of saying, you know, don't buy into the fact that this is where we are now.
You know, like, I've seen some weird, I've seen some weird social media stuff. Like one of my favorite ones is someone asked the question why Kamala Harris's name isn't Emhoff, and you know like a serious question, and someone explained you know the same reason that you know Ivanka Trump's name isn't Kushner. The same reason there's a bunch of this going on. Mind your own business. But I think my favorite meme was you know you've got these people who go, Donald Trump's going to fight for the country. He's going to fight for us. I saw one that was just a classic response to that.
Yeah, one of my favorites was Donald Trump will do whatever it takes to fight for the country. And then somebody just responded, except for the bone spurs.
Bone spurs, yeah. So, I mean, fortunately, I think now you're starting to see some of the weird, some of the crazy, some of the bizarre, some of the not normal being called out in a way that people are finally, I think, maybe shaking awake. And I'm hoping that the not extreme, because you're never going to get the fives, but the fours start going, maybe this is weird. Maybe we do need a little change.
I agree. And I think, you know, you're right. You're always going to have the fives that are on Trump's side and they're going to be the loyalists. But you start talking about the threes and the fours who maybe don't vote in every election, but do in presidentials and, you know, I think those folks would look at somebody like J.D. Vance and look at the way that this campaign is being run and think, you know, either I'm out entirely or, you know, God forbid they vote for actually what we're seeing in polling is that a bunch of people from Trump's side have been switching to RFK Jr. And then a bunch of RFK Jr. people have moved from him over to Harris, who were previously anti-Biden. That was probably the most interesting thing that I saw in a couple of the polls, yeah. The post-RNC poll and post-Harris first week poll. That batch of polling was super interesting to see, you know, that Steve Bannon really wanted RFK Jr. in this, thinking that, you know, oh, he's a big Democratic name. He'll pull away a bunch of votes from Joe Biden, and now it looks like it's happening the other way around.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're going to look back at this cycle and say, you know, Trump came out of the convention no bump and has tanked since.
Yeah, I mean, the dude got shot at. He had the convention. He named, you know, his VP candidate. These are all things that in traditional politics and in a normal election would give the candidate a bump. But I mean, I think you and I were talking after the shooting thing where I was like, I don't think he's going to get a bump. I think people are where they are. They are locked in and there is a 1%, you know, wiggle room here. And I don't know that issues like that matter to them.
No, we've talked about this for a while. I don't think there are any new Trump voters.
Yeah.
I think it's just going to be a matter of who, if you get enough people to come out to the polls on that day, if it doesn't rain. And that's the sad thing about having our elections on a Tuesday. But what's interesting to me, and again, weird, is that you've got a guy running for president, wanting to lead the most powerful nation in the world, and he's out there hawking sneakers in crypto. I mean, you know, it's weird. Again, I hate to keep using that weird word, but it's weird.
But again, like this is someone who has astronomical legal fees and desperately needs some money. So of course he's going to try and figure out how to merchandise everything. That's who he's been his whole life, right? Trump steaks, Trump vodka, Trump wine, Trump University, like across the board. So of course Trump sneakers are going to be next because the Trump hat has been huge. But the Trump hat is a campaign thing. So he had to come up with something that is specific to him and to his brand, and a gold sneaker is the way to do it.
Because
then he got involved in all these crypto bros. And so he branded a bunch of sneakers, gold sneakers that say Bitcoin on them. And now that is the marriage that is just, I didn't see that one coming.
Not on my bingo card. But you know, here's the thing. Shouldn't he be thinking about how, oh, I don't know, to improve healthcare, to you know, maybe have a policy on investing in infrastructure, have a policy to reshore manufacturing. Oh, never mind. Biden's already done all that. But shouldn't he be talking about, you know, what he wants to do instead of trying to fleece the flock. I mean, that's the part that gets me. The one thing that he's come out, I guess he's now in favor of crypto. This is, again, this is weird to me because I don't know any red hats who are in favor of digital currency.
That really struck me whenever he posted. So after he posted the thing about his, you know, crypto tennis shoes, he talked about, he made some comment about how, well, maybe this is the way that we save our economy. We just change the American dollar into crypto. And I was just like, you have no clue. Like, there is no economist in the world who is going to be okay with that. Just none. And you're right. Like, that's for red hats and for people who are really big on like privacy and don't Like, I mean, not just like uterus privacy, but like don't want their names on stuff and, you know, want to be able to hide from the government. Like those right wing prepper people, they're not going into crypto. There's no way. They're stuffing their mattresses full.
No, I mean, look, you know, the reality is I'm not in favor of digital currency for a lot of the reasons that you laid out there. But more importantly, I just think having that kind of control mechanism is just bad. Whether you're on the side of the Joe Rogans and the extreme right and the, you know, they're going to turn off your currency, or if you're on my side of going, you know, I like to have a little money in my pocket. Not everything should be a credit card or a debit card, or, you know, heaven forbid they start chipping our hand with cash chips. I'm not gonna lose that.
I know, and thank God there are enough hipsters in the world who are just like totally against that, and will always stand up for actual cash and a good hot top hat. You know, gotta love it.
Finally, we gotta get your thoughts on Elon Musk since we're talking weird. It's weird, seems to be the thing. What's going on with him? What's this this new report that's come out?
Okay, so this is wild to me. He has a super PAC that he's called America PAC. Donald Trump's super PAC is called Save America PAC. So they're pretty similar. Basically, what he has done is he's dumped like $800,000 into Google ads and Facebook ads and YouTube ads. And he's asking people to register to vote, except whenever you put in your information, like, you know, here's my email address and here's my zip code. If you're in a non-swing state, like Oklahoma, Washington, D.C., places like that, it kicks you over to the website where you, as a citizen of that state, would register to vote. Now, if you're in a swing state, what it does is kick you over to this massive form that asks for every single detail about you. I mean, basically like firstborn blood type kind of stuff, right? And then at the end of it, it just says, thank you. And it doesn't kick you over to any voter registration. It hasn't registered you to vote. And so everybody's kind of like sitting back going, whoa, this is straight up fraud. Like, you're telling people that you're registering them to vote, and then you're basically just stealing their data, and they're not being registered to vote, even though they think that they are.
Yeah, because I can see people going, look, I went through the form because I thought it was the voter registration form. I didn't know Elon was sitting up at night, breathing heavy, reading my information.
Yeah. And they're going to turn that into a campaign where then he wants to spend money, where he knocks on those doors and gets those people out to the polls. But again, like, if somebody has registered, thought that they had registered to vote, and Elon Musk didn't register them to vote, it's not going to matter if he GOTVs those people, because they're not registered. So I don't know what he's thinking, but his model is really stupid. But there is a completely horrifying piece of how dishonest and fraudulent that kind of thing is. And I really hope that somebody investigates it, like DOJ investigates it.
No, I see. I can look at this and go, okay, as long as you answer the questions right, we'll then help you to register. If you answer the questions wrong, you go into this purgatory, this limbo land, and you don't get to vote. And I kind of see that this could be one of those ways that you segregate out the people you don't want to vote, and focus on the people that you do based on how they answer your series of questions. So this is really, really kind of nefarious.
It's definitely nefarious. And I mean, again, like, this is why I think, you know, there should be some kind of fraud investigation.
There ought to be a law.
There is, there is, right, there should be a law. There is a website. It is a nonpartisan, a nonprofit, completely normal website called vote.org. You register to vote online. It registers you for every single state. No candidate is getting this information. Nobody's making money off of this. Like, it is a legitimate, safe place for people to update their registrations and register themselves to vote. So go there instead, please.
Yeah, well, we come back. Bob Ney is going to be here, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. He helped write the Help America Vote Act. So maybe this would be a good question for Bob when we come back. But Sarah, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time. Keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. Have a good week and hi to Bob.
There you go. Our good friend Sarah Burris. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are we surprised it's Elon? And doesn't weird kind of fit perfectly there? I think so. Back after this.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Showers and storms in the overnight with heavy rainfall a concern and flooding issues as well. Upper 50s at daybreak, gusty east winds. Any leftover clouds will give way to sunshine. Tuesday afternoon's high in the middle 70s. Right now it's 58.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Milwaukee County Board Chairwoman Marcelia Nicholson.
The moment I walked out of the auditorium, I said, it's our time now. It's the little girls that look like me who wake up with brown skin and sometimes wonder, do they matter? To have someone like Kamala, who is not only qualified, but representative of voices that have been ignored for far too long, it felt like all things are possible.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you go from very positive that this could be a way to save the courts, save our faith in our Supreme Courts, historic lows of approval from We the People, looking at the nine in robes. On here to share some cold water on what could possibly be, and answer the question, why now? I've asked our good friend Ian Millhiser to come share some thoughts. Ian's got a piece over at Vox right now. Biden's new Supreme Court reform proposals are mostly useless. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Rick.
That's a bit harsh, don't you think? Useless?
I mean, the way I look at it, I'm a policy reporter. Like, other people can talk about like what the politics are or like what the political fallout of this could be. My job is to look at what would these things actually do if they became law. And the answer to that is not much. These are really modest reforms. And on top of that, you know, Biden proposed three ideas: term limits for the justices, getting rid of the Trump immunity case that was just decided, and then making them have an ethics code. And at least two of those would require a constitutional amendment. And that ain't happening. Like, it's impossible to amend the Constitution. You need three quarters of the states to agree. If there's any meaningful political faction in the country that doesn't want something to happen, you're not going to get a constitutional amendment. And there is a big political faction that doesn't want these to happen. It's called the Republican Party. So, I am happy to see the Democratic Party deciding to go after this court, which has been just awful. You know, I'm happy to see that in an election year, they're realizing that they need to attack the center of Republican power in Washington, D.C., which is the Supreme Court. But the policy proposals themselves, they're meh.
But isn't this is, you know, and as I was thinking about this on Monday when this came out, this is very, very Democrat. This is that, you know, in a street fight, they're offered to hold your coat. And I was hoping that with Kamala Harris, this would maybe change a little bit, because the right wing message is, you know, she's this attack dog pit bull. So I was hoping for bigger, for bolder, you know, maybe expanding the court to 13 to match the districts, maybe something that you could really, I don't know, get your teeth into.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem here is that, like, the way that the Constitution treats the Supreme Court is really weird. Like, you know, maybe I won't use street fight as a metaphor. Maybe I'll use a bar fight as a metaphor. Like, imagine you were in a bar where if you, like, say a nasty word to someone or if you throw a punch, the bouncer will be on you in a second and throw you out. But if you stab someone, the bouncer is going to be like, okay, that's cool. That is kind of how the Supreme Court, how the Constitution treats the Supreme Court. So term limits, you know, overruling a bad constitutional decision of the Supreme Court, really modest stuff, generally requires it either requires a constitutional amendment, or like if you want to overrule a decision, you just have to appoint a bunch of justices who want to overrule it. That's really hard to do. But like one thing that you can do like that is court packing. You know, the Constitution gives Congress the power to decide how many justices sit on the Supreme Court. There have been as many as five. There's been as few as five. There's been as many as 10. So Congress could tomorrow, if it wanted to, add like 6 seats to the Supreme Court. Biden could fill them all. And then we'd have a 9-6 Supreme Court. The reason why no one does that, though, is because that completely delegitimizes the judiciary. It invites a tit-for-tat situation where the next time Republicans are in power, they're going to add a bunch of seats, and soon we have dozens of justices, and they're all a bunch of political hacks. So you can do the biggest, most damaging things, you know, the equivalent of stabbing someone in the middle of the bar to the Supreme Court. But if you want to do something sensible and moderate, that's actually not on the table.
Yeah, no, and look, I like the idea that they're talking about doing something, but like term limits, that seems to be the right's fetish. And look, I get it for Congress people. I get, you know, you make that argument. I'm against it because I think we have the ultimate term limiter. We can vote the bums out. But the Supreme Court's a whole different scenario. So when you have bad actors, you know, like, and I would argue Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito are bad actors, and they seem to be, appear to be bought and paid for, There should be a way to usher them along.
Yeah, I mean, I'll confess I have some ambivalence about term limits. I mean, you know, Clarence Thomas has been on the Supreme Court since 1991. That's just a really long time for someone to hold that sort of awesome power. And I mean, I know a lot of judges. A lot of the judges are really great people, but like, one weird thing about the job of a judge is everyone you encounter in your professional life has to treat you with a kind of ritualized obsequiousness.
Yeah.
You know, it's all your honor this and yes, your honor that. And like if you're arguing a case and a judge like disagrees with you, you have to find like the most polite way possible to respond. You know, I clerked for a judge. He was a great guy, but like I couldn't be in his presence unless I had a suit on, and I had to treat him with an extraordinary amount of deference. And I don't care who you are. Like, after you've lived like that for 20, 30, 40 years, it's just going to mess with your head. Yeah. So, like, I see the argument for term limits. Oh, my dog likes term limits. You can hear it. You can hear him endorsing it. At the same time, like, I don't know that term limits are going to solve the problem of a court that's too partisan or too ideological.
Right.
You know, Reagan's appointees were worse than Nixon's appointees. Bush's appointees were worse than Reagan's appointees. Trump's appointees were worse than Bush's appointees. And if Trump gets a second term, they're going to be worse than the first term appointees. So, like, if you swap out someone like John Roberts, who's very conservative but more moderate than, you know, what Trump is likely to give us, for, you know, another Alito or another Gorsuch, you've just made things worse. You know, there are good arguments for term limits, but I'm not sure that it'll fix this ideological, very partisan court is one of them.
But even if you wanted to do term limits, wouldn't you have to pass? I mean, we're never getting a constitutional amendment. I don't think I'll ever see one in my lifetime. Because I don't think you're ever going to get 290 people in the House and 67 senators to agree on any one thing. And then to throw on top of that, as you pointed out, 3/4 of the states to pass it as well. So is there a legislative way to enact, you know, term limits and, you know, and this code of ethics that the Supreme Court justices aren't going to go, no.
Yeah. I mean, term limits, I really don't think there's a way to do it without a constitutional amendment. I mean, the Constitution's pretty clear. It says the justice shall serve during good behavior, which has long been interpreted to mean as long as you don't like commit some egregious form of misconduct, you get to keep your seat. And being old is not misconduct.
Yeah, but being in the pocket of some billionaires, that seems like misconduct.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem is that the remedy is impeachment. And so, yeah, I mean, there's no question that Thomas and Alito should resign. I mean, you shouldn't be allowed to fly around on some billionaire's jet, you know, and then go back to your government job, no matter what that government job is. You know, no other branch of government will tolerate that. But the problem is that the remedy is impeachment. And that means you got to get 67 senators, which, you know, that's the same problem you have with trying to get a constitutional amendment done. I mean, could there ever be a term limits amendment? I don't know. Like, if 30 years from now, like, imagine that, like, Elena Kagan, who's a Democrat, and Amy Coney Barrett, who's a Republican, are still on the court, and they're both senile, and they're handing down, like, just ridiculous, crazy, like, it's a problem that both parties recognize, that you've got these two folks who have stayed on well beyond their competence, and one's a Democrat and one's a Republican. Maybe under those circumstances, I could see a term limits amendment passing. But right now, Republicans have a 6-3 majority. Term limits are a threat to their majority because anyone who's term limited out right now would be replaced by Joe Biden. So, you know, they don't want that to happen. And so, you know, they don't care, you know, if Clarence Thomas loses his marbles tomorrow, they'd rather have a Clarence Thomas who can't remember where he put his house keys over any Democrat.
Right. But isn't the argument, you know, the argument that I heard most recently was that we would like grandfather in these justices. Right. So that it would be the new ones, and that there could be a way possibly to get around this by, you know, what was it, rotating them through the circuits? Like, because evidently, yeah, you're the expert here. Evidently, each justice is supposed to oversee a circuit, which is why the argument for 13 justices actually makes a little bit of sense. But that they would then rotate through that, it sounds convoluted, but I'm sure you've got the idea.
I mean, there's an argument for it. I mean, I actually think it's a pretty persuasive argument that you could apply term limits to future justices. The argument is that the specific language that the Constitution uses is that federal judges shall hold their offices during good behavior. And so Congress could change the nature of the office that a new justice is appointed to. They could say, like, you're being appointed permanently to a circuit court, which is a lower court position, and then we are also giving you a temporary assignment of 18 years to the Supreme Court. And so that is the office that you hold. It is a different office than the current justices hold, which is a seat on the Supreme Court for life. And I mean, I think there's a plausible argument that you could sort of get around the Constitution that way and implement an 18-year term limit or however long you wanted to make it for future justices. But I mean, first of all, that doesn't solve the problem of the justice that we have right now. And second of all, like, even if you can come, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, you can come up with the argument. I just told you what it is. I think it's a pretty good argument. But the people who have to decide whether that argument flies or not is the Supreme Court. And so, like, if you are a justice who's been appointed to the Supreme Court and they want you to leave and you don't want to leave, all you got to do is get four of your buddies to say you don't have to leave, and then you don't have to leave.
So we have a broken court. And you said, if we're going to solve this problem, there is no solution to this problem, is there then? I mean, we're going to have to live out the and suffer through the pain that's going to come from the bad decisions that are yet to come. Not just the ones that were already decided, but the bad decisions that are yet to come.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there is no solution. I think there are two solutions. I mean, one, the more radical solution is you can pack the court. And I mean, that I think would require extraordinary majorities in favor of it. There'd have to be a widespread national backlash against the Supreme Court. You know, Franklin Roosevelt famously tried to pack the Supreme Court when he was at the height of his popularity, and Franklin Roosevelt was more popular than any modern president has ever been. and he wasn't able to do it. So, you know, it is an extraordinarily heavy political lift. But you can imagine if the court keeps handing down outrage after outrage, you know, imagine a dozen decisions like Dobbs. Imagine a dozen decisions like the Trump immunity decision. Like at some point, you could imagine there being enough of a political backlash that a bill could pass. So that's one option. The other option is just to do it the old-fashioned way. You know, justices leave. They die. They retire. You know, they eventually get off the court one way or another. And, you know, how did the Republican Party get rid of Roe v. Wade? Well, they did two things. They organized and, like, made sure that anyone appointed by a Republican president would oppose Roe v. Wade. And then they just waited for enough justices to rotate off the court at a time when a Republican was in office, and they eventually filled the court with justices that they knew were going to oppose Roe v. Wade. So what I think Democrats need to do is they need to decide what's on the list of cases that they want overruled. You know, I mean, I think certainly the Trump immunity decision should be on it. You know, a lot of these cases giving the court the power to overrule, like, any federal regulation should be on it. Dobbs should potentially be on it. And then, you know, what the people have to do is just keep electing Democrats to office so that those Democrats can eventually fill the court with enough justices who will take the court in a different direction.
Yeah. Is there that mechanism on the Democratic side? I mean, everyone's giving credit for the current Supreme Court to the Federalist Society and this Leonard Leo guy and all the money that went into creating that environment. Is there anything like that on the other side?
There is. I mean, I think that, you know, the Federalist Society works because the Republican Party is, like, more homogenous and, like, more willing to turn things over to, you know, a bunch of rich guys who, like, mostly support what they want to do. The Democratic Party doesn't work like that, but, like, the Democratic Party has a broad consensus that abortion rights should exist. You know, the Democratic Party has a broad consensus that, you know, the Trump immunity decision was wrong. You know, Biden and Harris wouldn't have both come, you know, the sitting Democratic president and the Democratic presumptive nominee wouldn't both have come out in favor of getting rid of the Trump immunity decision if they didn't know that it was unpopular. So, like, you know, I think that the Democratic Party is responsive to, you know, views that are overwhelmingly shared by Democrats. And so, again, it, you know, it's on all of us. If there are people who, you know, believe that that there's a certain thing that the Supreme Court needs to do and it should be on the list, you know, then we need to organize in favor. You know, if you don't like some of the anti-union decisions, then the solution is, you know, unions need to organize and they need to tell Democratic presidential candidates, if you want our vote, this is what your Supreme Court nominees need to support. You know, if you want our endorsement, this is what your Supreme Court nominees need to support. So, I mean, you know, politics only works one way. You organize. And, you know, there is a path forward. You know, it is a slow process. I mean, I'm sure I don't have to tell you or your listeners that, like, organizing to bring about political change isn't something that you could do over the course of a weekend. But is there a path forward? Yes, that's it.
Yeah, and it's not what people want to hear, though, Ian. We live in the fast food society where you drive up to the window, you get the bag, and it's instant gratification. You're talking, you know, how long did it take Republicans to take over the court? How long has this been? 50 years in the making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Roe v. Wade was on the books for 49 years. And, you know, Republicans started, you know, coalescing around the idea they didn't like Roe v. Wade as recently as the Reagan administration. Affirmative action, the Supreme Court's decision saying, I mean, Bakke from the 1970s was a very limited decision. It said that affirmative action was only allowed in very limited circumstances, but that was around for about 50 years. And, you know, Republicans organized, it took them a long time. I don't know that it necessarily has to take 50 years. I think that the Dobbs decision, you know, getting rid of Roe was so unpopular. I think the Trump immunity decision is so unpopular that, you know, especially in the case of the Republican campaign against Roe v. Wade, they were organizing against the will of a majority of Americans. I think it is easier to organize when you have a majority of the people in your favor. But we are talking about a project of many years here. Yeah. And I think, you know, we need to be cognizant of that, that, you know, we are talking about a project that isn't going to be solved by one election, but that can be solved by several elections.
But it starts with one election, and it starts with this election.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Because at every election that the Republicans win, they dig us deeper into a hole.
Yeah, and it starts with this election. I mean, because there's the thought that, you know, who knows, in the next term there could be another one or two. I mean, Sotomayor and Kagan aren't getting any younger.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, Clarence Thomas is in his mid-70s. You know, so is Samuel Alito. You know, they're at the age where it would be reasonable to expect they might have to leave the Supreme Court. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe Kamala Harris gets in there, and in her first term, Thomas and Alito have to leave the court. Now we have a 5-4 Democratic court, and it's morning in America again. Like, you know, it could happen very quickly.
I don't wish them any ill. I don't want to go there. Maybe take some of those vacations from Harlan Crow and the billionaires. Maybe do that full time.
Yeah, no, I want to be clear. I wish them both a long and very fruitful retirement where they, you know, they have lovely lives wielding no power over anyone ever again.
There you go. Ian, as always, great stuff. Hope folks will take a look at the article over at Vox. Biden's new Supreme Court reform proposals are mostly useless. Written by Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent there at Vox. Ian, as always, great talking with you, man.
Great talking with you, Rick.
Again, you know, I love the messaging. I love the fact that we should be fighting for something. Just wish it was bolder, a little chunkier, a little meaner. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day that the NFL Players Association went out on strike. The American Football League and the National Football League officially merged that year. Each league had their own Players Association. With the league merger, they joined forces into one union. The players elected John Mackey, a tight end with the Baltimore Colts, their first president. Frustrated by pay and lack of control over their careers, the players voted to strike. The strike lasted for 2 days. The owners threatened to cancel the season. The NFL used its powerful PR machine to vilify the players in the press. They characterized the players as greedy and stoked fan anger over the walkout. The two sides met again at the bargaining table and reached a collective bargaining agreement. The agreement covered 4 years. The players won improvements to their pensions and dental care. They also secured the right to have agent representation for the first time. But many of the disagreements over pay and control remained unsettled. In 1974, the players were back out on the picket line for 5 weeks during the summer. 8 years later, a 57-day strike disrupted the season. 7 weeks of games were canceled. Then again, 5 years later, the union went on strike during the season. This time, some of the players crossed the picket lines, including stars like Joe Montana and Lawrence Taylor. This broke the strike without settling on a contract. Today, the NFL Players Association continues to push for improved player safety and revenue sharing. The impact of concussions on players' long-term health remains an important issue for the union.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this story over at Meta. I'm trying to delete a Facebook page. It's darn near impossible. But Meta CEO Zuckerberg, during some SIG graph event on July 29th, said that the potential for AI is to help people. Especially creators, help them do more, not less. And he said that what the vision is they're going to help people digitally simulate their personalities and their businesses online, so that, you know, you could eventually have your own, you could clone yourself to do all your work for you. You could, you know, you could have, you know, a you who goes to digital work, and then you get to go play or do. I'm guessing this is the idea. Now, as I was thinking of this, you know, my mind went to, okay, you're going to clone yourself. You're going to make like a digital twin, not clone. You're going to have like a digital twin, and it's going to have your personality. It's going to respond as you would respond to things. And I started thinking about it, going, is this a good thing? I mean, what if I don't like my digital twin? What if I don't like it? What if I don't like my personality on my digital twin? Can I change it, or am I stuck with this now digital me? It's a weird kind of thing, but oddly enough, you know, brought to us by Zuckerberg. And I guess this is the brave new world. This is the future. We're going to have digital relationships with ourselves. Weird. And finally, I got to talk about this story. ProPublica had put out an article on Trump's media company. And, you know, we've heard a lot from the right about, you know, Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and, you know, all of this claims of malfeasance, of corruption, of, you know, all of this stuff that supposedly happened, which is odd because Republicans have had the House and have done a very poor job of really investigating any of this or coming with any concrete evidence. Lots of smoking water pistols, but no real evidence. But ProPublica reports that Trump's media company, you know, the Truth Social thing, evidently wants to start streaming, you know, like television, like kind of like Twitter does. I guess they want to start streaming longer videos or TV on their Truth Social so that, you know, it's like a one-stop shop for everything Trump, I guess. And as ProPublica pointed out, there are a number of groups that want to buy into this, and a number of technology firms. But one of them that wasn't mentioned in the press release was this JedTech LLC, which was mentioned in the securities filings. Now, when they did some digging and they found out who was behind this JedTech, it's a Louisiana energy magnate, a guy named James Davidson. Most people have never heard of James Davidson, but he's a huge Republican donor. He's got massive influence in Louisiana and on the federal level because he's got a lot of money. And he spreads it around a little bit, makes sure that, you know, people who, you know, make sure that people who need it get it. And of course,